Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll get back to talking about the firing of James Comey in a little bit with Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post. But right now I have the pleasure of welcoming to the show Danish journalist Puk Damsgaard. She's a Middle East correspondent for the Danish Broadcasting Corporation and has covered some of the most dangerous areas of Syria and Iraq. She has a new book about the capture of fellow Danish journalist Daniel Rye at the hands of ISIS. The book is titled The ISIS Hostage, One Man's True Story of 13 Months in Captivity. Puk Damsgaard joins me now from Cairo. Thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you begin by briefly telling our listeners about some of the areas you've reported from and the conflicts you've covered over the last few years?
Yeah, I started working in the Middle East 6 years ago, right after the Arab Spring, the Arab Revolutions. And since then, I've been covering most of the area, mainly Syria. For the last 2 months, I have been in Iraq, mainly the city of Mosul, where there's a big operation going on against ISIS at the moment. But I have been everywhere in the region for the last 6 years.
In the book, you wrote that you couldn't avoid the presence of ISIS in Baghdad and Syria while reporting from both nations in 2014, and you narrowly escaped an ISIS suicide bombing while covering a Shiite party election meeting. It was around this time that you said an added risk arose because journalists had become targets of ISIS. Is that still the case?
Yes, but not as much as before. We saw the risk coming forward when the Syrian war developed, and we were many journalists in the rebel-held areas that were covering the conflict. And as the rebel groups developed, as ISIS developed, it became increasingly dangerous. We never knew exactly who we were talking to at some point, and whether we could trust them and or not. And that's the moment when it became very dangerous.
Do you think there's a lot that we don't know about ISIS-controlled areas because it's too dangerous for journalists to spend time in them a lot, including maybe how they treat their own people, especially women?
Of course, there are nuances and stories and information we don't get because we simply can't be there, because we can't be embedded with ISIS. I would also question what we would be able to see if we then became embedded. That would be another question. The ISIS areas are becoming liberated by, for example, Iraqi forces. Information start to emerge. I have personally talked to many people. I've been following a family for a long time who have been living under ISIS control. So, of course, we get more and more information as these areas open up. But there have been times where it's been very difficult to have connection to people living in these areas.
Your book focuses on the capture of fellow Danish journalist Daniel Rye. Tell us a little bit about Daniel Rye and how he ended up becoming a hostage of ISIS.
Yeah, Daniel was a young photojournalist when he first time went to the Middle East, and he wanted to go to Syria like many other young photojournalists. And he had actually prepared himself pretty well. He had been speaking to a security guy. He had been doing research. He had been doing one research trip to Turkey to try to understand the situation across the border in Syria. And when he finally enters Syria, he enters at a very difficult time when things were changing on the ground. A month before he entered, ISIS had formally been announced. What that exactly meant on the ground for people, nobody was really sure of. But Daniel actually ends up kind of walking into his own kidnapping, so to say.
And he was arrested, I see, by the Jabhat al-Nusra faction just outside the northwestern city of Azaz in Syria. I think of al-Qaeda as being al-Nusra, and that's different than ISIS. Is that not the case?
Well, it was a bit unclear to begin with whether it was Jabhat al-Nusra, like the Syrian al-Qaeda, or it was ISIS. But now we believe that it was like a rebel group that very right after Daniel was taken, announced their affiliation with ISIS. And briefly after, he was moved to Aleppo, where he was clearly under ISIS control.
What did they arrest him for? What was the pretense?
Well, he walked into a building to get a permission that he was told to get to be able to take photos. And when they arrested him, they blindfolded him, they took his glasses off, they handcuffed him, they put him in a basement, and they accused him of many things. They accused him of being a spy for the Danish government. They accused him of helping with attacks against the rebel groups and so on. And later on in his captivity, he also had to hear a lot for the Danish cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that was published in 2005. He had to hear a lot of accusations about that as well.
He was tortured, you're right. And you're right, over many decades in Syria, torture had developed into an absurd art form. I'm afraid to ask, why do you call it an absurd art form?
That is how Syrians themselves have described it to me. Syrians that have survived the prisons of the regime, both during the current regime, but also the former regime under Hafez al-Assad. And that's because the regime is known for experimenting with all kinds of torture methods. And what was interesting when I started to look into this was that rebel groups and also ISIS actually copied some of these torture methods, also because some of the people that had the control over Daniel in captivity had themselves been in Syrian regime prisons before. So it's almost like these torture methods go through generations and are just being copied along the line.
What did he endure?
Well, of course, many different things. It was a 13 months captivity. It was worse in the beginning because he sat alone and didn't have anyone to talk to. He was beaten under his feet. He was not given any food, any water. He was hanged from the ceiling for 24 hours in a row. When he had British kidnappers, the infamous now Jihadi John among them others, when he got into their control, there was like all these games and beatings and so on. Some prisoners also we know were waterboarded, for example.
I want to play a couple of clips of Daniel Rai from an interview that he did afterwards in 2016. The torture took such a toll on him that he describes that it pushed him to the point of suicide. This is just 30 seconds. Listen.
I was pretty sure that I would never be able to come home alive after what they basically started doing with me. I was like, my family and friends should not witness me being executed in a video or whatever, so I might as well, you know, do it myself. So for me, that was the only thing. And after that, they made sure that I couldn't do that again, even though I wanted to for a long time.
What a position to be in, to consider killing yourself so that your family doesn't have to see you killed in a hostage video.
Yes, and this was actually the first month that I described before that was the worst for Daniel, because he sat alone. When he later on started to have fellow hostages next to him, among them three Americans, James Foley, Stephen Sutloff, Peter Kasich, Brits, Spanish people, French people, he started to regain his strength. They helped each other a lot when they sat together. So his worst time for sure was the first month where he saw no other way, as he describes here, as trying to kill himself. And luckily, you can say, his kidnappers saved his life.
And Daniel Rai's family was able to raise roughly 2 million euros to secure his release from ISIS. Now, the Danish government doesn't negotiate with terrorist groups taking hostages as a matter of policy, but Daniel's family was able to secure his release by using a loophole in Danish law. What was that loophole?
Yeah, so as you say, Danish government don't negotiate with terror groups. They had a private security guy that's also described in the book. He was actually also looking for James Foley. And he negotiated with the kidnappers. And the loophole in our law is that, you cannot pay money to terror organizations. You can't fund terror organizations, but it doesn't say anything. It's like a gray zone, so to say, about whether you can pay a ransom to rescue someone's life that is a hostage with a terror organization. So secretly hid in the hiding, the family collected these money because one condition from the kidnappers was that they could not go out openly in the media and talk about this case. It was secret until the end that Daniel was sitting with ISIS. So they spent months, very, very nerve-wracking months, to try to collect this amount of money. And at the end, they were punished with another 5,000 euro per day for every day that went by where the money had not been given to his kidnappers. Huh. So it was a very tough moment for the parents.
I'm curious, are you at all afraid as a journalist who covers war zones that you're more likely to be taken hostage because of this payment, because the, you know, ISIS or whoever might think that there's more of a likelihood that they'll get money for taking you?
Yeah, for sure. It's always a risk. Not always, but sometimes it's a risk that we have to be very aware of. And in my work with this book, of course, it's eye-opening and heartbreaking and scary story that I don't want, and I don't want anyone else to end in this situation. And for ISIS, it became a big business, obviously, next to many other businesses they had. And this is also one of the reasons why many governments refuse to negotiate. Of course, it puts a huge pressure on the families who can't get their loved ones out, because there is just no way of trying to negotiate in any way.
Before you go, and listeners, after we finish with our guest, Puk Damsgaard, author of The ISIS Hostage, One Man's True Story of 13 Months in Captivity. I believe this is being made into a movie, by the way. I'll ask Puk before she goes. We're going to have Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post with the latest on the obviously still developing story of the firing of James Comey and the aftermath. That's coming right up. But I want to play one more clip of Daniel Rye. He was held hostage,
yes,
with American journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, and American humanitarian workers Peter Kasig and Kyla Mueller. James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, and Peter Kasig were all beheaded by ISIS. And in February 2015, ISIS claimed Kyla Mueller was killed in a Jordanian airstrike in Syria, which the White House denied, but confirmed Kyla had in fact died. Here is Daniel Rye in 2016 discussing the guilt he felt when he was released, given all those other deaths.
Right away, I was very excited. And then I completely lost all the excitement inside myself. I felt so bad. I felt so ashamed about the feeling I just had. Because, we had this thing that we wanted to leave it together. We had this idea that when we're going to be released, we're going to the hotel and we're just, eating everything from the buffet, and we are, having long showers, and we just imagine how we would experience this release together.
So it's not bad enough that he spends this time in captivity by ISIS and is tortured. He has to deal with survivor guilt when he gets out.
Yes, for sure. It was only a couple of months after he came out that they started to kill his people that have became his friends. And this is something that he will have to live with the rest of his life. He has many good memories from the time in captivity, though. It wasn't only torture, and it's actually some of those stories that I have found interesting writing about, because it's amazing what people can do together when they sit together. When it was at its highest, there were 19 guys in one cell trying to make the best out of it. Of course, it wasn't always easy, but they tried to make the best out of it, getting routines, somewhere doing yoga, then there were gymnastic lessons, then there were other kind of lessons. They tried to have a daily routine despite the terrible situation.
This story and your telling of it in the book is going to be made into a movie?
It is. It's being worked on at the moment, yes.
In Danish?
No, it's going to be an international movie with an international cast, of course.
The book is The ISIS Hostage, One Man's True Story of 13 Months in Captivity. Danish journalist from the Danish Broadcasting Corporation, who herself has spent a lot of time in the Baghdad and, I should say, Iraq and Syria war zones, Puk Damsgaard. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.